Our first class is entitled, The Lord Shall Yet Comfort Zion and Shall Yet Choose Jerusalem. We ask Brother Bill Link to come forward and speak to us now. Brother Bill.
Well, good afternoon, brothers and sisters, young people. It's good to be with you all. I was just trying to work out this morning when the last time I was in the Pittsburgh meeting was, and I was able to work it out because we have a picture we took out front, and we only had three kids, which means that it's been 16 years, which is too long. I'm very sorry. So much time's gone by, especially since I have such happy memories of the Pittsburgh meeting. I think of Truth Corps back in 1976. I think of a winter study weekend in Detroit. I believe that was 1976 as well, where there were two carloads of us going back to the East Coast, and we got into the most awful blizzard that you could imagine. Eddie Binch was driving the other car, and I remember we simultaneously realized we were in a very bad situation, and we both pulled over. We didn't have cell phones back then, but somehow we got to a phone, and we called Bob Palmer, and we said, we're in trouble. We need a place to stay. And Bob said, how many of you are there? We said, 12. And he said, good. And we came over and we were rescued. Wonderful thing the fellowship we have in Christ is. And I have very warm memories of your ecclesia. And I'm glad to be here today. So, Zechariah. Very interesting book. It's perhaps one of the more obscure books of the Old Testament. We hustle through it rather breathlessly from December 19th to 28th at a time when we're hustling through 2 John, 3 John, Jude, and 3/4 of the book of Revelation in our daily readings. I always have the sense at the end of the year that Brother Roberts has us galloping to the finish line with the daily readings. And it is a busy time of year. And the book has some puzzling passages. It has Joshua and Satan. It has a woman in an ephah. It has flying scrolls and passages that are surely messianic, but seem to be applied to other individuals. If it's not the most familiar book to you, you're likely in good company. So I always like to sing the benefits of Bible class. In our ecclesia, I know growing up, the Bible class was where you learn about the scriptures. Even as a young person, 12, 13 years old, you are learning in Bible class. And if by chance your ecclesia, I don't know about Pittsburgh, but if some of you are visiting, if your ecclesias are spread out so that you're not able to have Bible class, the idea of getting together with individuals and reading, the disciplined reading of the Word together is such a valuable thing. So in our Bible class, we, over the last few years, went through the Minor Prophets. And as we did it, we'd go back and forth to one of the letters of Paul. So we have New Testament and Old Testament. And eventually we got to Zechariah. And I had to confess at that time that I really wasn't terribly familiar with it. We got to the book and with a bit of trepidation started our study feeling that maybe we were out of our depth. But we came away from that study with a real feeling that this is a wonderful book, one that's really speaks to us as Christadelphians. So the title of my first class expresses the major theme of the book. And it's found in chapter 1, verse 17. The Lord shall yet comfort Zion and shall yet choose Jerusalem. This is a book about God's eternal purpose with Jerusalem. And as such, it's one we ought to be excited about because it's part of our Christadelphian heritage. The hope that we have that one day the law is going to go forth from Zion and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And they'll beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. And we have the vision of Jerusalem as the city of the great king. And we long for that day. And so it's a book we can get excited about. Zechariah has, by my count, I think 49 references to Jerusalem or Zion, which is a pretty good average given that there's only 215 verses in the book. In fact, if you take a concordance or your online Bible in this digital age, and you sort of scroll through a listing of passages referring to Zion or Jerusalem, the central theme of the book becomes very clear. Just show you a few as we start out today. Zechariah chapter 1, we're going to meet an interesting angel. This angel accompanies Zechariah through a series of visions that he sees. It's hard to really find exactly the right word for him. He's a host to the visions, but he's also a companion. He's an active participant in some of the visions. So I'm going to call him the companion angel. And in verse 12, it says, "The angel of the Lord answered and said, 'O Lord of hosts, how long wilt thou not have mercy on Jerusalem and on the cities of Judah, against which thou hast had indignation these 70 years? And so the answer comes in good and comfortable words. Verse 14, "Cry thou, saying, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, I am jealous for Jerusalem and for Zion with a great jealousy. Verse 16, I am returned to Jerusalem with mercies. Verse 17, my cities through prosperity shall yet be spread abroad, and the Lord shall yet comfort Zion and shall yet choose Jerusalem." And this was a very necessary and very helpful encouragement for these people because they were, we're going to set the historical context, but like us, these are real people in real circumstances and they're down among the weeds and you can't really see the big picture all the time. And the reassurance that God's purpose will be worked out is so encouraging to us. Chapter 2 has a vision of a man with a measuring line who's going to measure out the city of Jerusalem. And we're told in that chapter, verse 4, "Jerusalem shall be inhabited as towns without walls." Verse 11, that God will dwell in the midst of her. Verse 12, that he will yet choose Jerusalem. So Jerusalem is the focus of the book. In fact, I quoted a minute ago one of our sort of go-to passages for Jerusalem and the purpose of God. That's Isaiah chapter 2. We all are familiar with it. Zechariah has, in his 8th chapter, what's almost like an enlargement on Isaiah 2, with a description of what Jerusalem is going to be like in the blessed kingdom age. So from beginning to end, Jerusalem is the central theme of the book. It's about God's unfailing purpose. It's easy to get excited about Zechariah. So let's get started by getting a sense of the historical setting. One of the neat things about Zechariah is that we can rather precisely date, to the October 20th, 520 B.C. is an important date in the study of Haggai and Zechariah. We can get to the very days by the references to the secular kingdoms. Now, David, I don't think I have power here or something. Is this a standby button? I better not touch it. So I made up a little bit of a timeline here. And we're able to actually very precisely date many of the visions. So, for instance, chapter 1, verse 7 refers to the 24th day of the 11th month in the second year of Darius. And the commentaries tell us that this can be identified precisely in our modern terms to the 15th of February, 519 B.C. And so the first verse, which is 3 months earlier, is in December 520 B.C. Now you might say to yourself, well, so what? And maybe I am making too much of it. But there's something about this precise dating that enhances my appreciation of the book. It's as if to show that God's involved not only in the big picture, but on the daily scale. Our study of Zechariah is going to focus primarily on a very short period of time. So we'll take a minute and see where that period of time falls on a timeline. So I have a timeline there with some dots on it, reaching from 800 BC to 300 BC. First big date, 722. That's when the Assyrians took captive the northern kingdom. Next date we should have in our mind is 605, the Battle of Carchemish. This was when the Assyrian Empire was overtaken by the Babylonians. What do you think of as the capital of Assyria? Everybody think Nineveh, right? You think that's where Jonah was set and everything. Well, as the Babylonians came into the ascendancy, they chased the Assyrians out of Nineveh. And they went first to Haran, and then they chased them from there to Carchemish. And when the Assyrians were in Carchemish, they said, hey, we better get our allies down there in Egypt to help us out. And so the Egyptians came up through the land of Israel, and remember what happened along the way? Josiah interfered foolishly, and that was when he died. So the Assyrians, the Egyptians came up, they assaulted Haran, trying to take it back, but the Babylonians prevailed, actually went and destroyed the capital at Carchemish, and then Nebuchadnezzar went on his big journey of conquest. And it was in 605 that Daniel and the first wave of captives were taken into captivity to Babylon. All right, 597, further captivity, Ezekiel and 10,000 others. 2 Kings, we read that Nebuchadnezzar looted the temple. He took all of the leading craftsmen and warriors away, and he only left the poorest sort of the people of the land. He carried away all Jerusalem and all the officials and all the mighty men of valor, 10,000 captives and all the craftsmen and the smiths. None remained except the poorest people of the land. He set up Zedekiah, who was to be the last one in the line of David. You remember what Ezekiel says, thou profane wicked prince, whose day has come when iniquity shall have an end. I will overturn it, and it shall be no more until he come whose right it is. Zedekiah lasted 11 years and then revolted. And the Babylonians came down hard, burning the temple, deporting 40,000 to Babylon. And so the captivity, 70 years captivity, took place. 538, that's when Cyrus defeated the Babylonians. 537, the first return of the Jews. And the things we read about in the beginning of the book of Ezra, where they started rebuilding the temple. But there was local opposition. The people who dwelt in the land in that time period while Israel was in captivity, they didn't want them coming back. So they stirred up trouble. They said, look into your history books, kings. You'll see that this is a terrible, rebellious city that's going to cause you all kinds of trouble. And so the work of rebuilding the temple and restoring the city was shut down by force. And 15 years went by to the time when the work was stirred back up. It'd probably be a good time to open our Bibles and go to Ezra chapter 4 for some important historical background to our study of Zechariah. Ezra chapter 4, we read at
verse 1.
When the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the children of the captivity builded the temple unto the Lord God of Israel, then they came to Zerubbabel and to the chief of the fathers and said unto them, let us build it with you, for we seek your God as ye do. Verse 3. But Zerubbabel, who was the governor, and Jeshua, who was the high priest, and the rest of the chief of the fathers of Israel said unto them, ye have nothing to do with us to build an house unto our God, but we ourselves together will build unto the Lord God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, has commanded us. And then they go on a campaign, showing that their offer of help really hadn't been sincere in the first place. They do everything they can do to hinder the work. They fire off letters, making accusations. And when you come to the end of the chapter, the kings find out that the history of Israel has been one of that's been trouble to the nations about them. And so they say in their return letter, verse 21, give ye now commandment to cause these men to cease, that this city be not builded until another commandment shall be given from me. And so verse 23, when the copy of King Artaxerxes' letter was read before Rehum and Shimshai the scribe and their companions, they went up in haste to Jerusalem unto the Jews and made them to cease by force and power. And so this young band of people who had come back under the edict of Cyrus and started building, they'd come back with enthusiasm, with hope. They'd seen the fulfillment of the 70-year prophecy of Jeremiah. And they come back to build, and the work is hindered. The work is stopped by force and violence. It says in verse 24, then ceased the work of the house of God, which is at Jerusalem. So it ceased in the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. And that's where we are in the timeline right here, 520. Now, how many times when you're doing your readings in the Kings and Chronicles, or Samuel as well, there will be a reference to a prophet, a little obscure prophet, and we don't know anything more about him. It could have been the same with Haggai and Zechariah. We have two references to them in the book of Ezra. And all we're told is that they stood up and stirred the people up and got them working. And if that was all we knew about them, that would be pretty neat in itself. The neat thing is we actually get their books as well. So Ezra chapter 5, between the last verse of chapter 4 and the first verse of chapter 5, there's a 15-year hiatus. And then it says, then the prophets, Haggai the prophet, and Zechariah the son of Iddo, prophesied unto the Jews that were in Jerusalem, Judah and Jerusalem, in the name of the God of Israel, even unto them. Then rose up Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, the son of Jozadak. We're going to be spending more time with these two men in the second class. Zerubbabel's in the kingly line. He would naturally have been the king if it hadn't been ended with Zedekiah. Jeshua is the high priest. He's in the line of the priests. They stood up, it says, and they began to build the house of God, which is at Jerusalem, and with them were the prophets of God helping them. It's in this little time interval, 520 to 516, it's in that interval that the book of Zechariah fits. Now, I'll put a few more dates up here just for completeness. Esther would be about 473. The second return under Ezra at 458. For some reason, I think I had always thought of Ezra as being contemporary with the Haggai and Zechariah. But the fact of the matter is that the book of Ezra, which bears his name, it has this history, but it's all as background material for the work that Ezra does. And Ezra, actually, the man himself, he comes a good bit later, as does also Nehemiah. There's one last date I want to put on this timeline just to complete it. And that's because tomorrow morning in Sunday school, we're going to be talking about Zechariah chapter 9, which is a magnificent prophecy of
of Alexander the Great that we can identify to the year 332 B.C.
So there's the timeline. Now we are focusing our attention right down in on this period in 520 B.C. And I think we can see similarities for ourselves. These are real people involved in real day-to-day activities, facing real challenges and real frustrations. They had hoped to build the temple, and it had been stopped. Come over with me to the book of Haggai. Just before Zechariah, in the arrangements of the scripture, we're told what it was that Haggai said to stir up the people. It's a great exhortation for us. Haggai 1, verse 1. In the second year of Darius the king, in the sixth month, in the first day of the month, came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet unto Zerubbabel the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua the son of Jozadak the high priest, saying, Thus speaketh the Lord of hosts, saying, This people say, the time's not come, the time that the Lord's house should be built. And we might say to ourselves, you know, this is not the time for us to have that preaching activity. This isn't the time for us to do a seminar. We're facing opposition. People aren't interested. We can find all kinds of reasons to say this isn't the time. And we do precisely the same thing as the Jewish people did, that when we don't get involved with the things of God, we get involved in the things of our own interests. You know, so this is what Haggai said, verse 3. They came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet, saying, Is it time for you, O ye, to dwell in your paneled houses, and this house lie waste? Now therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. You know, so the opposition and force that had been brought to bear said they couldn't build the temple. Meant they said, well, we've got to back off from that. But then they put all their energies into their own activities. And, you know, it's easy to sit back and say there's foolish Israelites. But then when we start thinking about ourselves, you know, and evaluating our own lives, and where we're pouring our energies, we have to say sometimes we are pouring our own energies into our paneled houses and not into the things of God. And it's a good exhortation that Haggai said, consider your ways. His words were powerful. It stirred the people up and they got to work. Well, let's just do a quick overview of the book of Zechariah. And we'll see how Zechariah himself stirred up the people. We're going to spend part of the remainder of this class looking at his opening appeal, chapter 1, verses 1 to 6. Turn unto me. We're going to begin in this first class with what I call the night of eight visions. Because from chapter 1, verse 7, right to chapter 6, verse 8, is a series of visions, one after the other, with apparently no break among them. Then he goes from one vision to the very next. It was quite a night. And we're going to be going over those eight visions in our second class. So we'll have a full plate for the second class. The visions are entirely encouraging. They show God's presence, his unfailing purpose with Jerusalem and with his people, and how he will prepare the nation for worship. Next we have, just sort of sandwiched in at the end of chapter 6, this one unfortunately we're not going to be able to spend time on, but I'm glad to talk about it privately, an enacted prophecy commemorating the generosity of some of the Jews of Babylon who had sent money to the Jews in Jerusalem. Chapter 7 to chapter 8, that will be our third class. That will be the third class. This is my favorite part of the book of Zechariah, I think. And it's people are sent. It's halfway through the building project. And they're sent to Zechariah, the delegation sent, asking, should we keep observing the fasts that we've had all these 70 years of captivity? I mean, we're building. Looks like maybe that's all the past. So what do we do now? Do we keep observing the past? And God's answer takes two chapters and four visions, and it's
one of my favorite parts.
Now I have 9, looks like 9:14, 9 verse 14, but it should be 9:2:14 there. The remainder of the book is a series of undated prophecies that are somewhat different in style and in application than the first 8 chapters. So much so that some commentators say these are from a much later point in the life of Zechariah, while others, including even some conservative commentators, suggest that these are the work of another prophet that have been appended to Zechariah's book. There are indeed plausible arguments for Jeremiah. One way or another, though, the theme of Zechariah continues in these chapters, that God's steadfast purpose with Jerusalem will stand, that he will ultimately dwell within her. And so, for our fourth class in Sunday school tomorrow morning, we'll talk about chapter 9, and finally, for exhortation, we'll do Zechariah 14. All right, that said, let's turn off the overhead for a minute and open our Bibles to Zechariah 1, verses 1 to 6. And consider his opening appeal. Verse 2. The Lord hath been sore displeased with your fathers. Therefore say thou unto them, thus saith the Lord of hosts, turn ye unto me, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will turn unto you, saith the Lord of hosts. Be ye not as your fathers, unto whom the former prophets have cried, saying, thus saith the Lord of hosts, turn ye now from your evil ways and from your evil doings. But they did not hear nor hearken unto me, saith the Lord. Your fathers, where are they? The prophets, do they live forever? But my words and my statutes, which I commanded my servants and prophets, the prophets, did they not take hold of your fathers? And they returned and said, like as the Lord of hosts thought to do unto us, according to our ways and according to our doings, so hath he dealt with us. So Zechariah begins with an appeal to the nation's history. He speaks of God's anger with the fathers. He speaks of his appeals through the prophets.
You ever notice how certain people have a certain way of expressing themselves? They always use that same turn of speech. You find it in the scriptures as well. With Jeremiah, it's rising early and sending, rising early and speaking. God sent his prophets rising early. It's like at me, I don't rise early except when I come to Pittsburgh. Or maybe go out and sit up in my tree stand in the woods, but that's another story. I'm not an early riser. When you get up early, it's because there's something important.
Jeremiah says God had risen early, sending and calling and appealing. And he had appealed. And he said, turn unto me. And Zechariah says they hadn't done it. Now notice verse 3. Therefore say thou unto them, thus saith the Lord of hosts, turn ye unto me, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will turn unto you, saith the Lord of hosts. Do you notice anything unusual about that verse?
The repetition of saith the Lord of hosts.
Now, I'm always on my kids about what I call verbal debris. When I was a kid, I guess it was you know.
And now there's the like speech where you say, and I was like, and he was like, and she was like, and I was like. And then there's another one, there's the yeah. don't know if these have made it out to Pittsburgh, but there's this verbal debris. But this is not verbal debris. This is deliberate. And it makes the verse very easy for us to remember, right?
We ought to be able to commit this one right to our memory.
Thus saith the Lord of hosts, turn ye unto me, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will turn unto you, saith the Lord of hosts. This is God speaking. That's the point. Turn to him. So many times in life, the difficulties we face is because we refuse to turn to him. And it's not that God has separated himself from us, so we've separated ourselves from him.
And this was indeed the message of the former prophets.
Think of Isaiah chapter 44, which is the chapter which talks about how they go and cut down a tree, and they heat themselves up something to eat and get a little warmth from it, and then they carve an idol out of another part of it, and they fall down and worship it. And so what foolishness. God says, return unto me, for I have redeemed you. It's right through Jeremiah. Turn thou backsliding Israel, right? That's chapter 3. Backsliding Israel, turn to me. Have a look at this one in Amos chapter 4. It's like a refrain here in Amos 4 verses 6 to 11. Now God says, I've tried this, yet they haven't returned to me. Verse 6, I've given them cleanness of teeth, lack of food, yet have you not returned unto me. Verse 8, there's drought, so they have to send from place to place trying to find water, yet have you not returned unto me. Verse 9, I've smitten you with blasting and mildew, yet have you not returned unto me. Verse 10, at the end of the verse, he'd sent pestilence, yet have you not returned unto me. Verse 11, he's overthrown some of them as he overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah, and they were like a, note this, we're going to be seeing this in the second class, like a firebrand plucked out of the burning, like pulling a stick out of the fire that has been singed, but you brought out, you caught just in time. Yet have you not returned unto me. So Zechariah says, don't be like your fathers. Don't be like your fathers. Return to me. What an exhortation for us. You know, these are real people just like us. And they need to be encouraged
just like we do.
It's intriguing that in Malachi chapter 3, verse 7, Malachi being later on, that once again there's reference back to a former prophet, but this time it's Zechariah. And Zechariah
1, verses 3 to 4 is pretty explicitly quoted in Malachi chapter 3.
We need to turn to God. And we need to do it over and over and over again. And how much better off we would be if we would just put our faith in him when we're in the weeds. When there's opposition to our work, when it doesn't seem the time to do the Lord's work because we're facing opposition, turn to him. And so that's the opening appeal in the book of Zechariah.
Well, now come back to Zechariah chapter 1, and let's spend a minute with the first vision.
So, there are places in Zechariah where there's dates. You know, the opening appeal is dated to the 8th month of the 2nd year of Darius. This next event, verse 7, is dated to 3 months later, in the 11th month, in the 2nd year of Darius. We won't find any other date until we get later on in chapter 6 and chapter 7. And it's because what's starting here is a series of 8 visions that all apparently occur in one single night in the life of Zechariah. So let's get a mental image
of this first vision, starting at verse 8. He sees, by night, a man on a red horse. And the man stands among the myrtle trees that were in the bottom. Behind him there are red horses, speckled and white. And Zechariah says in verse 9, "O my Lord, what are these?" And the angel that talked with me, now we'll spend a little bit of time at him in the second class. This is the companion angel. He's called the angel that talked to me. So he says, what's this all about? What's the vision about? And the companion angel in verse 10, or verse 9, he says, I'll tell you what it's about. But before he can speak, the man leading the angels, I'm jumping ahead of myself. The man leading the horsemen down in the ravine speaks up and says, "These are they whom the Lord hath sent to walk to and fro through the earth." Now we're going to meet up with these horsemen from chapter 1, verse 11. Again, in the prophecy of Zechariah, in chapter 6. Just turn over a couple pages to chapter 6. The chapter starts off talking about chariots. There's red horses in verse 2 and black horses as well. The third chariot has white horses and the fourth grizzled and bay. And once again, Zechariah speaks to his companion angel and says, "Who are these?" And he's told that these are four spirits of the heaven which go forth from standing before the Lord of all the earth. They are described as having quieted God's spirit in the north country. And they are described in verse 7, this is the important one, as walking to and fro through the earth. It's an important phrase that I think is one that is a key to us to see that it's talking about the work of the angels. Chapter 4 has, and also in chapter 3, there is a stone with eyes in it. And it says these are the eyes of the Lord. Where it's all about God's vision of things. Really, great cross-references. It's one I have here on the screen of 2 Chronicles 16, verse 9. Which is the prophet Hanani speaking to King Asa. He says, "The eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong in the behalf of them whose heart is perfect toward them." And so what we have here in this opening vision is we have the angels of the Lord present in a valley, in a ravine. I want to say something about the myrtle trees, and it's I lost it in my notes, but come back to that. Anyway, the picture is of God's awareness of His power and control, and these angels are there to walk to and fro through the earth, and their message in verse 11 is this: we've walked to and fro through the earth, that's through the land, and behold, all the earth sitteth still and is at rest. So in this first vision, we're given a picture of God's awareness of His power, His control, and that things are settled. Now, if we think of the circumstances, Haggai and Zechariah had gotten the people to recommence the building of the temple. It's been 5 months to the day. And the outcome isn't a settled thing yet, because they're still facing opposition. You come back with me to Ezra chapter 5. There's a real good connection there to this. Ezra chapter 5. That the opponents who had once stopped the building are now saying, at verse 3, hey, you're starting building again. Who's told you to do this? Verse 4, then said we unto them after this manner, what are the names of men that make this building? But the eye of their God was upon the elders of the Jews, that they could not cause them to cease till the matter came to Darius.
Now that key phrase there, the eye of their God was upon them.
So, the vision is of God's angels being present, of His Spirit being present, and the eye of their God, of God is upon the people, and He's going to prosper the work. Now, how often do we need such encouragement? When we see the opponents, we see obstacles to our work, we might remind ourselves of Elisha with his servant when the Syrians were surrounding the city. The servant says to Elisha, alas, my master, how will we do? And Elisha says, fear not, for those that are with us are more than they that be with them. And Elisha prayed and said, Lord, I pray thee, open this young man's eyes that he may see. And the Lord opens his eyes and he sees what? The mountain full of horses and chariots of fire round about Elisha. We need to be reassured that those that are with us are more than those that be with them. It's marvelous reassurance for faint-hearted saints. This same language carries over into the Apocalypse, where we see the Lord Jesus portrayed as a lamb as it had been slain, having seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God, sent forth into all the earth. It wasn't a settled matter yet that the work would be successful. Ezra 5 tells us how the adversaries attempted to stop their work. And Ezra 6 tells us of how Darius ordered a search and found Cyrus' edict. God's eyes were upon them, and he prospered the works. And so this first vision is indeed, as it says in verse 13 of Zechariah 1, good words and comfortable. We're going to spend a little bit more time with this companion angel in the next class. But I like how involved the angel is in the events that take place. Verse 12, the angel of the Lord answered and said, O Lord of hosts, it's the angel himself crying out, how long will thou not have mercy on Jerusalem and on the cities of Judah? He's spoken good words and comfortable. And those words are then repeated to Zechariah and to us. We'll conclude with a summary of verses 14 to 17 with seven assurances for Jerusalem. In verse 14, God says, I am jealous for Jerusalem. He cares for Jerusalem. And he cares for us. We're part of his purpose. He's sore displeased with the nations. And he's sore displeased with the evil of the world that's around us. Verse 16, I am returned to Jerusalem. I think it's a prophetic perfect, talking about things that aren't completely done yet, but it's as though it's already completed. I am returned. It's that sure. I am returned to Jerusalem with mercies. Verse 16, my house shall be built. The house of prayer for all nations for which we long. There's to be a line stretched forth, a surveyor's line over Jerusalem. The cities through prosperity will be spread. And the Lord shall yet comfort Zion and shall yet choose Jerusalem. So this is the first of the eight visions. And I can imagine that Maybe Zechariah wanted to hop up out of bed and run and share these comforting words with his fellow citizens. But it wasn't the time yet. He had 7 more visions to see that very night. It was going to be a long night and a very comforting and very encouraging night. And that's what we'll take up in our second class.